dear. Okay, hi everyone. My name is Melinda Sackington and I'll be talking about artificial intelligence. So to just jump straight in. Yeah, I realized I didn't plug this in. So ever since the Industrial Revolution, we've had a fascination with stories about artificial intelligence. And just thinking of recent movies, we've got different variations on the same theme. How does having AI change our world? So I'm a huge movie geek, but for my day job, I work at a company called FutureLearn. And we're basically a social learning platform. So we work together with universities and cultural institutions all over the world to create online courses. And this means that our team is encouraged to learn more about the theory and principles of pedagogy. How do we build great learning experiences? Now, my own background is in AI. So what I realized from learning about how to do good learning experiences is that how machines, the artificial, learn is very similar, obviously, to how people, or the unartificial, learn. So that's what this talk is pretty much about. Just explaining some concepts from AI and then linking them to unartificial intelligence. So before we can look at the unartificial and or the artificial, we need to figure out what is intelligence? How do we define this? So what makes something or someone intelligent? So I did what every geek would do, and I looked it up in the Dungeons and Dragons manual. Now, the parts about wizards and spells aren't really that relevant to us here, but these parts are. How well your character learns and reasons, and having a wide assortment of skills. Here's another definition. So, intelligence is not just about having knowledge or skills. It's not about being intellectual. It's about knowing how to obtain these knowledge and skills, how to reason about them, and how to use them. So what do we mean with artificial intelligence? Well, we actually use it for two different things. On one hand, we use it for the actual intelligence of machines and software, but we also use the term for the research field that's looking at creating this intelligence. And within that research field, we can think of four different areas, four different approaches that people take when trying to implement AI. So these are kind of the four different things that you think about. So today I'm only going to look at one of them, which is systems that act rationally. And this is very much looking at the idea of intelligent agents. So an intelligent agent is one that always tries to do the right thing. So one that tries to achieve the best outcome no matter the circumstances. So here's a basic diagram of a simple agent. It lives in an environment. It has sensors which it can observe the world with. And it has effectors with which it can take actions on the world. And then within we have three different components that it uses to make decisions on what actions to take based on what observations it has. So it creates a state of what the world is like, uses condition action rules, so these are just very simple if-then rules, and then it decides what action it should do. And when we're talking about humans, we're pretty much the same. So we, again, live in an environment. We have sensors, which are our five senses, sight, sound, etc. And we have effectors like our voice and our hands and our movements that we can affect the world with. And then again, in the same way, we create a state of how the world currently is, and we've got these rules in our head about what we should do in which situation. So this is most apparent in looking at someone at the research of Pavlov. So I'm assuming everyone here has sort of heard about Pavlov before. Hands up if you have. Yeah. So he was a Russian physiologist, and he was known for his work in classical conditioning. So he trained dogs to associate the sound of a buzzer with food. Now, a couple years ago, I tried to do the same thing with my cats. So these are my cats, Casey and Dusty, and they're always hungry, and they get really annoying when they're hungry. So I thought, can I train them the same way Pavlov did? So they started out like normal cats. Whenever they smelled food, they'd know that they'd, well, almost get food. So they'd jump up and rush to the kitchen, knowing they'd soon get to eat. I then started training them with a very simple iPhone alarm. So I only get up and feed them if that alarm played. And eventually they started associating that sound with food. I ended up not continuing the experiment because it still turned out that they were hungry all the time anyway, and that didn't really stop them from not being hungry. But even now, and it's about 3-4 years later, whenever they hear that alarm sound, like on a TV show or a movie, they'll jump up and rush to the kitchen expecting that they'll get food, which is kind of cute, but sometimes really annoying. So we're not that different from cats, and we use these same principles on ourselves to form habits. So for instance, each morning when I hear my alarm clock, I know that that means I need to get out of bed, even though I really don't want to. As a developer, I know that when I see failing tests, this means that I should go and fix them. But these are very, very simple loops. How do we actually learn these rules about which action we should take? How do we learn new things? So here's a more complex diagram of what we call a learning agent. So in this case, it's again, we have an agent, which is an environment, and it has sensors and effectors. But we've now got a couple more components, which are a bit more complex. So to start, we have the performance element. And this is pretty much the same agent that you saw before, which creates a state of the world and has condition action rules and to decide what actions to take. Only now, in this case, we have a couple more components which can influence the way we learn about these decisions. So the main one that we're interested in here is the learning element, because this is the one that we use to learn things. We then have the critic, which based on past actions decides which ones worked and which ones didn't, and feeds that back into the learning element. And then we have the problem generator, which is all about experiments. So if we didn't have this, we'd constantly do the same thing over and over again. So we're much more interested in having something that also allows us to plan and try out new stuff and just be a bit more experimental. So how do we define the learning elements? How do we know what changes to make? So this is where learning algorithms come in. So I'm not going to go into too much detail here, just very quickly explain some of the basic type of learning algorithms. So there's supervised learning. So in this case, all the feedback that the algorithm gets is upfront. You get a bunch of label training data, and you're basically trying to infer the rules of which input belongs to which label. Then there's unsupervised learning, and this is basically just a bunch of data that you get. And here it's about identifying the patterns or the structure from the actual input, even though we don't have any labels or specific output supplied. And then there's reinforcement learning. And here the feedback is actually proper feedback. The agent makes a decision about something and then gets feedback about whether or not that was the right or the wrong decision. So in the same way that machines can learn through different types of algorithms, we as humans learn from different types of activities. So here's a quick overview of the 16 different types of learning activities. And again, I'll just highlight a couple of them, but if you want to look at the slides later, they'll all be explained. So the first that I want to look at is delivered. And in this case, it's about learners that are presented, in this case, the learners are presented with information. So it's all about consuming content. So this is very much like supervised learning, where you're presented with the content which contains all the information that you need to learn something new. So as developers, we do this when we're trying to learn something by reading books, or watching videos, and attending conferences. It's very much about consuming content. Then there's conversational and collaborative learning. So this is about learning through conversing with others and through constructing a shared understanding with other people. So this is again similar to unsupervised learning, where basically the learning comes through the structure of what is being learned rather than the content being delivered. And this is similar as, and again, we do this as developers with pairing. Together, we're basically forming a shared understanding of what we're working on. Then there's assessing. So in this case, it's about learning from constructive feedback. So again, this is quite similar to reinforcement learning, where the feedback you get is what is used to learn. And as developers, again, we do the same thing with pull requests. We put our code out there and we ask for constructive feedback, assuming you have the right colleagues, and from which you can learn from. So here's again the overview of 16. So I want you guys to think about the last time you learned something. How was that? What did you do? Was it purely by consuming content? Or was it in a slightly different way? Was it through getting feedback from someone? Was it through conversation or through collaboration? And we need all these different things to properly learn something. So what makes us different from machines? Well, for starters, anything new we learn, we know in what situation and what context we're learning it. Unlike machines, we're not really bound to one domain or one purpose. We're just, we've got all these different environments that we're learning from. And next to that, we're constantly learning. We don't have an off switch for not learning. No matter where we are, we're learning new skills and knowledge, and we're always processing everything around us. Whereas machines are very much state-based. They need to be in a specific state of, I am learning something now, and I am acting on something now, and I am doing something else, like, I don't know. So we are very much non-state-based. And then there's prior knowledge. We've got years and years of backlog of other things that we know. And we can make associations between all the different types of information we have and discover patterns and connections in ways that other people might not have. And next to that, we're emotional. And even though that's not really something that I think developers like to talk about, we attach value to certain skills and information and experiences. And we need emotion to be able to make good decisions. And finally, we're social. We learn from other people. We learn through attending conferences and conversations with people. So right now, we started creating machines that do all of these little bits separately, but not all of them combined. And machines need to be able to do everything combined in a much more generalized way before we can consider them learning the same way as we humans do. But I don't think we're that far off. So I'm making a little prediction. I'm not the only one to have said this, but I think we'll have artificial intelligence within the next century. And I don't think this will be the type of AI that is plotting out downfall and causing the end of the world, but rather it will be machines that can learn and reason about the skills and knowledge that we as humans do. And that's, I think, when things get really, really interesting. So in a world where humans and machines learn the same way, does that mean they'll learn together? Will our schools become places where humans and machines both learn? So when we're thinking of designing and developing stuff for the future, consider this. Will what we develop for humans also be used for machines? And will what we develop for humans also actually work for machines? So that's it. Thanks for listening.
It's probably safe to say this is the first talk you've been to featuring a bowl of spaghetti hoops. People are often surprised to discover that, in fact, for my day job, I teach the clarinet, saxophone, and the piano. Isn't it also the norm to be tinkering around with software and hardware? But my atypical background in music, combined with a notable amount of inner geek, has allowed me to embark on a unique project combining music, education, technology, and spaghetti. I started volunteering at Seashell Trust because I wanted to see if I could use music to have a positive impact on children with learning difficulties. Seashell Trust is a school for children with some of the most severe and complex needs in the UK. Each child has multiple disabilities, as maybe visual impairments, hearing impairments, autism, and every child has only the use of little to no verbal language. Because of this, a lot of the children are reluctant to touch everyday objects And this can lead to problems with eating, dressing, feeding. And so I wanted to do something about this. As a clarinetist, it was soon clear to me that music had a profound impact on these children. It seemed to connect with them in a way that nothing else can. So I wondered, could I use this effect to actually encourage students to achieve in other areas of their life that they found challenging? Bring on the inner geek. So I started experimenting. And as you can see here, it is indeed possible to make everyday objects musical, especially ones like bowls. And this got me wondering, could we actually use these bowls to help students achieve to feed and to eat? And it was around this time that the members of staff at Seashell started to note what I was doing, take notice. And I arrived one Thursday morning to discover that a demonstration had been set up for the head teacher, all the bigwigs, to show what I was doing next week. But what would I demo? I was against the clock. As I say, I had thankfully got some idea of what I might do to help these children and what I might do. So I did some initial tinkering around, some experimentation, and I had a game plan. But it was the evening before this demonstration, and my project looked like this. A little bit of work to go. Lick of electric paint, so far so good. A few hours passed, twiddling my thumbs. Hooked in the microcontroller, green light, all systems go, so far so good. Next step was critical because I was really no going back on this. I got to protect this in some way. Cover it up, so I've got some sticky back plastic. This might seem easy, it wasn't. But thankfully, as you can see here, luck was on my side. I managed to get it covered, electric paint intact, the prototype lived. All that was needed now was some bowls of food and a volunteer. Anybody like to come and dunk their hands in some bowls? Anybody go? They don't work at the same time at the moment, sadly. Excellent. So, thank you. And actually, the great thing about that, as well as encouraging these children to explore different textures, often what happens is. You didn't know, but you put your hands in your mouth, you lick your fingers, which is fantastic because actually this is a way of potentially opening up their diets. A lot of these children are on really restricted diets, so if there was a fun way to help them, this was fantastic. Of course, there had been. So how was all this built? Well, good news is it's using lots of low-cost technology here. At the heart of it, as you say, a type of Arduino, we've got a touch board, which is based on the Arduino Leonardo, but with a few extra goodies thrown in. It's got MP3 player capabilities, an SD card reader, touch electrodes. As you can see here, electric paint, so conductive paint, only needed really small amount of that pot, so this is £18, wasn't that at all. And then this YW1, that's basically a speaker. But here, it's the good thing about the WAWIs is it really makes the surfaces they're on vibrate quite strongly, which again is fantastic sensory feedback for these children. Now, of course, behind the scenes there had been a little bit of coding going on. As a musician, I've got a lot of experience using Mac's MSP, so I initially set it up using that, but then later I dinkered around with some of the MP3 libraries to get the functionality we've got now. So actually, it works as a standalone. I'm just using the laptop to power it. And so, where do we take it from here? Now, thankfully, this works great as a demo, but it's not very kid-proof. It needs to be able to survive a good soaking. It needs to be shaped. You know, all of these things. So I've got a lot of work to do. But I had no budget. So largely, my further development has consisted of trawling the supermarkets for various jelly moulds, Tupperware containers to try and make this stuff work. So here's just an example of some lights I made from some jelly moulds from Morrison's. But Tesco liked me as well. This is a Tesco value Tupperware bowl. And this is actually the first half of a later prototype, which you will see. But this actually has worked fantastically well as a standalone device. We have at Seashell got a fantastic percussion project going on now using the gamelan instruments here. And lots of musicians come in, but some of the children who have got very limited mobility in wheelchairs can't actually interact with these instruments very well. So I thought, what could we actually do to bring this experience to them so they can actually experience playing a drum, feel vibrations? And that is why we got this. So you can't hear that very well, but you've got a drum loop going on there. So I recorded one of the musicians, and this activates just by either, so by touch. So they can use their ear. So for those that can only move in a very small amount, they can have their ear touch it. You can actually touch it with your hand as well. And you might see where I've been originally going with that device. Here, we've got two Tupperware containers together. Some of you may recognise this gentleman on the left. This is Mr. Tumble, and if you've got small children, and if you work in special educational needs, he is the top celebrity go-to. So I wanted to use his theme tune to actually encourage these children to, again, interact with the water. So this is a more sturdy, rigorous version of what you see here. A little quiet, but you can hear it works, you can dunk your hands in it. And there's one child who is absolutely obsessed with Mr. Tumble. And we tried it out with him, and he did indeed, this is a child that actually won't generally take direction. So he won't actually, if you give him an instruction, it's too much for him to actually carry that out. But he repeatedly put his hands in the bowl, looked at his hand in amazement and was licking his fingers, which is, say, my thing alone is a small thing, but it's a fantastic achievement, and this is hopefully going to really help open up his diet. And water went everywhere, so in terms of user testing, this, I'd velcroed it down onto the table, so as well as what you might think, and as we had here, nice polite dipping hand in the bowl, hand dunked in the bowl, shaking it like that, and nearly threw it off the table. But there was water everywhere on the table, but it survived, it worked. So that was a real success, and that was fantastic to see. So, what next? Now, as well as all this development, I'm really keen to see, to research, whether these interventions work. A challenge with research in this area is that often it can be very difficult to quantifiably measure what works and what doesn't. But here, we can use the very same technology used to generate the music to measure whether the interventions are effective or not. Do these students interact with the objects which have been modified to behave musically more than the objects that haven't? Another question is whether these sorts of low-cost interventions could be used to help other populations. On the right there is my granddad. He has dementia. And it's known that a lot of people with dementia can be prone to suffer loneliness as their cognitive and communication abilities decline. but there's lots of examples where music making in groups can be really used to foster a sense of community. Could these same sorts of interventions be used with this population to great effect? With all this work, I really hope that my research will be able to enrich the lives of populations who otherwise, in so many ways, find it difficult to reach out to the world. Thank you very much. Any questions?
Hello, I'm Tom, and me and a few other people I know have spent a year trying to get rid of the taskbar off the bottom here, trying to convert a caravan into a spaceship, because why the hell not? That's basically the reason for doing it. So there's a couple of us now. There's myself, there's Tim, who's sitting back there and continually sending me stuff on my Pebble to annoy me while I'm talking, and there's Charles, who's not here as well. He does all the electronics and other bits and bobs. So what we did is we built a freaking spaceship. Because essentially, has anyone heard the game Artemis? Yeah, you've been here before.
Played it.
Yeah. We got a copy of that and played it and thought, this is fun. Wouldn't it be really cool if we could get stuff to explode and blow out of the walls and drop out of the ceiling and smoke machine and lights and stuff? Needs more explosions. So I started, I got hold of the developer, mailed him and said, can you tell me how your network protocol works, please? Because I would really like to be able to write a listener for this to do cool stuff. And he said, no, we're going to use DMX. All right, okay, fair enough, I'll do it myself then. So sat there one morning with a copy of Wireshark and sat and wrote a Python proxy for it, which sits there and will take game events and ping them out using Open Sound Control to whatever you've got listening on your network. That's on my GitHub account if anyone feels like playing with it. I think it still works. I haven't updated it for a while. Pull requests, please. So we come up with a few problems, right? We thought this would be a really cool thing to drag around to make affairs and events and stuff and get people to come and play. But you can't teach people to play Artemis in about 15 minutes because it's a sim. It's not. You can't just sit there and go, no, I'm flying a spaceship. You tend to blow the thing up if you do that. So we thought, you know, how about let's have a go at writing our own one. So I've been playing around with Unity at this point and thought, you know, how hard can it be to write an entire simulator of a spaceship that doesn't exist? And we thought, well, if we do that, where are we going to install it? Jokingly, someone said, maybe we could get an old caravan. And then we bought one. And it came with free mould and creepily a teddy bear embedded in the wall, which was a bit weird. 250 quid, it turned up on a flatbed truck with straps around it because the shell is not really attached to the chassis at all. It is now because we fixed it. So that turned up and that caused some problems with it parking in the Hackspace car park because the landlord wasn't very happy with us. And then we had to kind of, we started panicking and had to kind of clear all the rubbish out. You see the lovely, the colours aren't very good, the lovely orangey 70s curtains in there. This disgusting plastic waterproof wallpaper, which took an age to strip, and then we had to waterproof it by painting it black, obviously, because it's a spaceship. And then we made it safe, and we've got a frame inside to kind of hold the front up. And then we thought we'd actually get on with the hard work, which is building the spaceship. So we thought, this is a big project. None of us know what we're doing. It's great. It's the first Unity thing that I've ever worked on, other than just making a cube bounce when you hit the space bar. And we thought, you know, it was sort of problems like, you know, we want to have a player console in front of you, like with controls and stuff on it. How are we going to do that? How are we going to get that to integrate the main game? So I started looking at Unity networking, which is horrific and needs to die. And we ended up using Open Sound Control because I can't remember why. I found library script for C#. I didn't want to write my own. And this is the first ever version running on my old laptop, which got stolen during the project. You fly around an asteroid belt, and there's an Arduino down here, and every time you fly through a box in there, it makes a light blink on it. And that was like the first kind of proof that I could get hardware outside of the game to interact with the game. That worked well. So we came up with a bunch of design rules while we were figuring this out. We thought every player should be doing something. But you shouldn't. The entire ship shouldn't die or explode if one person can't do their job properly. It should make it difficult for everyone, but you shouldn't kill everyone because you suck at doing what you're doing. That may have gone out of the window now. There are certain ways you can blow the ship up if you don't know what you're doing. All the buttons in the cabin have to do something. I don't want people flicking switches and nothing happens because it's pants. And we don't want touchscreens because it's Starbug, not Star Trek. I just said that there, yeah. It's more Starbug than Star Trek. Star Trek's hard to pull off without vacuum form in a professional set design team. Starbucks easy, you just throw stuff all over the walls, wires everywhere. You can leave bare wiring everywhere, and people say, hey, that's really cool theming. You're like, no, that's actually a network cable that runs the front of the ship. So we had this design process, which is basically a bunch of us would say, wouldn't it be really cool if, and that would happen, you know, on the toilet in IRC, or walking back to that space in a pub, or watching something on TV, or, you know, someone would go, wouldn't it be really cool if? That happened a lot, and then it usually resulted in, oh my god, yes, let's do that. And then I'd sit and write some code, usually on my lunch break at work, which confused most of my colleagues about what you're doing around a spaceship. Fair enough, leave him alone, he's obviously mad. Also, I wrote quite a bit of it on the toilet as well. And then we'd implement it and play around with it and laugh a lot, and then it would go back to step one of, hey, that would be really cool if we built a transporter. So we slowly kind of, a mission for the players coalesced out of this. You'd start the ship up, which is a task in itself. You'd launch the ship from the docking bay, fly around, prepare for hyperspace, slingshot around Mars, fly through a training area, return home and dock with bays, cup of tea and everything. What actually would happen is the slingshot maneuver goes wrong and you end up... there's some spoilers in this. The ship ends up breaking and you have to kind of get up and repair. It's really cool watching people do that because they don't realise you have to get up and physically connect cables together. And the look of joy on their face when they're like, you know, I have to stand up and pull things off walls. Like, yeah, it's a damn spaceship, of course you do. The training area is actually a bit of a war zone with live targets that shoot at you, which gives the tactical officer something to do. And the docking station is a little bit like Elite in that it's rotating, but we didn't bother writing the docking computer because that's boring. And also, lots of other bad things happen. And there's a really good reason that other bad things happen. It's not just bugs anymore. We've got a tablet in the back room, so we decided to not bother with an AI because, or trying to write an AI because I hate doing that. It's not fun. I want to make things explode and stuff. So we decided to trap a person in what used to be the shower of the caravan and is now a transporter room. So we've got these 30 quid Android tablets. They're pants, but they can display a panel of the buttons and get on the network perfectly. So you see we've got things for like the damaged ship, reactor fail, self-destruct, which is a good one because you can't cancel that from in the game. It has to be the captain in the cabin has to kind of go like, authorization for override, blah, 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 and if we're feeling in a good mood, we'll cancel it. So we can control all of the ship systems from the back room, and we can kind of trigger bits of the game and story and stuff like that. It's more fun for us if we're playing this for like 8 hours at a festival or something, if one of us is in the back room actually getting to toy with the players rather than just watching. So at that point, we're like, okay, let's actually get... We've done all the physics. I've got an idea of what we're going to do. let's actually build it. So there's the shower. It's now a transporter room. We found a huge chunk of wood behind our old flat and turned it into a dashboard. And you see there's monitors embedded. The little screen in the middle is the comms screen. That's actually a Debian laptop. It's probably the only time ever that Debian's been used on a spaceship. So we found loads of old... You know, where can we get all these switches and buttons and stuff from? So I found an old cash register and pulled the keys out of it. That's now was a USB keyboard. It broke, so we've replaced it. This is all done with sort of Arduinos and other little... the Minimus board, which is really good for hacking PS3s. They're about £2.50 in bulk, but they make good USB keyboards. This is the reactor control panel with blinky lights and a whole mess of orange wire. There is so much orange wire in the caravan, it's amazing. Tim's shaking his head, it's brilliant. There's kilometres of orange wire. And you know it's a ground wire because it's got a knot in it. That's our wiring system. This is some photos of the dashboard being built in the old hackspace before we move. And then on the right-hand side is the engineer console, which is kind of like a freestanding wooden frame that didn't fit in the van, and we had to cut the top off and we put it in. And we did all this with the idea of taking it to Maker Faire in 2013. And so the night before, we pretty much did most of the work on it. We were awake till about 4 in the morning doing this. We installed the dashboard, we got the engineer console in, which didn't fit, and we had to chop the top off. We attached the door properly to the transporter room rather than just with some knackered hinges. We installed most of the hardware and all the panels and switches and stuff. We did most of the work on it the night before, you know, where most of the work gets done. Then we found this problem. This is 7:30 the next morning, getting ready to take it to Maker Faire. We hired a truck. Oh no, we had a tow bar attached to Charles's girlfriend's car, and we found the connector on our part of the van was rusted to, was completely rusted and was the wrong one. So we had a crash course after 3 hours sleep at 7 in the morning trying to fit a new one on it. That was fun. I now know enough about caravan connectors, which is fun. So we had a 6-hour drive, which was spent asleep. We'd actually forgotten to bring all our network cables with us, so we didn't have anything working. We spent most of the morning basically finishing it off and apologising to people for not being able to see how it worked and things. we got it working. And there it is. That's the first time it ever worked as one thing. That's the war zone. There's a giant ship that has picked up. Can I kill these lights? Yeah? There's a little switch. Oh, that'll do. That's better. So that's the main screen. It's actually a projector. It's still the same projector. We haven't broken it yet. And on the right is the weapons console. And on the left is the pilot with the radar. The centre you can't see is because no one's called you. It's the comms screen. And people are always impressed with how we get really good low latency streamed video to the centre console. And we don't. We just run a very long USB cable to a camera in the back room. it's perfect. And most of the weekend was essentially, we'd start a game up, we'd get a crew of people and explain to them, this is the first time ever, you're the first people who ever played this, we literally finished building this morning. We'd start the game, something would break, and we'd always have someone in the cabin pretending to be captain and helping things along. Turns out it's actually a really good idea anyway, so we do that all the time now. Something would fail, we'd kind of storyline over it and go, oh, that shouldn't happen, let me call the control guys and say, yeah, you know, such and such is broken, and I'd note down on a notepad that something had died. I then 15 minute gap where I'd fixed the issue, and there was a lot of them. And then we bring another crew in, and I kind of apologise that things are going to break, and bear in mind this is an experiment spaceship. A lot of people, I think, thought that was part of the story. There wasn't. Now, after this is like, so the last year and a half, we've been kind of in this expansion phase of like, let's just put more things in and go mad with it. There was a bunch of problems, like the engineer console wasn't very fun. It had a grid of keys that you had to tap in the right order, but you couldn't read them because they were tiny and it was dark. So we bought some USB lights and things, and Ben just decided to get rid of that pants. The radar was confusing. Turns out 3D radars are confusing for people that haven't flown things before, I suppose. Having a captain inside the cabin is awesome and works really well for glossing over problems, and also it's fun. And one of the puzzles is based on connecting USB cables in the dark in the right order. they broke, so we got rid of that. And then we had this kind of, you know what would be cool, let's like crack the windscreen when you hit things, because it's a windscreen, not a view screen, that was one of the design decisions. How about success screen for when you actually land, because that never really happens. Let's put more switches in, what things fall off the walls, can we get a self-destruct to really kill off people that are annoying us? Can we put a chase cam and shove it on a projector outside so other people can watch? Let's record players with cameras and then stream that to the internet. Can we have a button that's marked, do not push? So there we go. We've got a projector outside, and you get like a nice view. Well, we don't do this anymore because I think we've got a use for the second screen now. But top right there is that's the new engineer panel. Those are nuclear reactor control switches. So you have to kind of flick them. It's basically Space Team. It says the coolant flow is broken, and you turn on some valves. But they're all switches. They're all wired into something, and it works. There's the do not push button. That's now changed to an unmarked light lit up switch, which every now and again will blink. And people will go, why is this blinking? And hit it, and then they get a warning to not hit it again. And if you do it twice, you get a punishment. If you do it a third time, it self-destructs the ship, which is running up there. We added blinky lights, because they don't mean anything, although there is an amusing joke there, which you can't see on the projector. They're Christmas tree lights, because Christmas tree lights automatically blink, and you just need to turn them on and off when the ship starts and stuff. And they got this really cool like 2001-style look, because they're incandescent bulbs. I broke quite a lot jamming them through the holes as well, so Christmas tree lights, yeah. And we decided to start running, on Tuesday nights occasionally we run a speed test, a speed run sort of thing, where three of you get in and you have to try and get from the start to the end via a kind of automated mission. 4 minutes 26 was a record, but that's now wrong because we've changed so much in between. And then we were like, hey, let's James manual. Part of the ship dies and you have to start repairing it. So we built an emergency repair kit, which is a box full of IEC extension cables. And there's loads of sockets around the cabin. And you can see on the bottom right picture, there's one plugged in there. We've got rid of the manual, and now all the consoles will shut off until you reconnect these properly. It's much nicer having it in software, because we can really start fiddling with it without having to go and print it and laminate it and put it in and test it. Although having a manual is kind of cool. It's a pain in the butt to update, so we don't really do that anymore. There's the engineer console on the left, it's quite an old one. There's some lovely, moodily lit shots on the right of the reactor running, and someone, I think, failing to run it, which is quite cool. But then we started adding more things, like, the actual player console should crack and break as the ship gets damaged. We rebuilt this panel so it actually looks not rubbish. And the weapons console has now got configurable weapons as well. At some point we plan to let people choose what kind of weapon they're taking on the ship. They won't really have much of an impact in the game, but it's kind of cool to go like, yeah, let's arm this with missiles and a chain gun and sort of long-range lasers, and then all those little screens down there will tell you what you've got. And, You can't see in the photo, but there's a gigantic green glowing trackball on the right hand side as well from an arcade machine, which is quite cool. And you just target things and shoot them with it, it's kind of easy. That on the left is a friend of mine's Land Rover. And I notice he's got these really cool kind of makers, like ownership stamp things on them, so I'm like, I'm licking that idea. And we made one for the spaceship on the right with the dry weight and the, you know, the chassis number and all these kind of things on it. We've got lots of little silly detail things we put in. So on the first version of it, we had quite a simple layout. There's like a network switch, three PCs, one PC in the back running it all, a network smoke machine, projector, cabin lighting and things like that. And we're like, okay, this is cool, but now it's kind of grown a little bit. So we're probably the only caravan spaceship in the world to have Wi-Fi, which is kind of neat because we've got two Android tablets, one for the video system. Oh, yeah, video system. So the bottom right there, you can see we've got video server and five cameras. Floss UK, I'll give them a bit of a shout-out for this, gave us a little grant to basically buy five nice HD IP cameras, which we dotted around the cabin. You can just about see them running. And they run into a gigantic server, which runs StoneMix. And we mix them all together, and from that, from the tablet, you can control which stream is currently live. You can cut and fade between them and things, and we stream those to like Twitch and Ustream and stuff like that. It's also really cool for debugging. You put a new feature in and watch the confused looks on people's faces while they try and do something. You're like, maybe I should change that and make it a bit easier. So we're actually an open source project as well, which is quite nice. The entire game, all the console, all the code for the player machines, all the Arduino code, all the artwork, all the audio work stuff, all of the DXF files for laser cutting bits of the cabin, it's all in the GitHub account. If anyone wants to download this and make their own and commit stuff back to it, it's really cool. We do know, I think, of two other people that are trying to do something like this. There's a guy in Melbourne, I think. He's started doing a similar sort of thing. He started by building the controls and then working out how to put them in a spaceship rather than building a spaceship and put the controls in, which is a bit weird. And there was... I can't remember who the other guy was. There was someone else who wanted to do a similar sort of thing as well. And he was like, oh, I can get hold of the code. And yeah, you'll be scared when you read it, but yes, you can go for it. So we're based at London Hack Space near Cambridge Heath Station at the end of Hackney Road. We generally try and run the games on Tuesday nights, so we've been a bit lazy recently, recently being about 4 months. We do have a Twitter account and a website as well, and we do sometimes take it to events, although I don't think we're moving it at the moment because there might be some sort of mechanical problems with actually shifting it. And we do stream to Ustream sometimes as well, but I think the camera system's dead at the moment. That's it, and there's the ship leaving the hangar. Isn't that nice? Any questions?